This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 82 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted like exactly like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com. And listen, you are definitely going to need that practice today because we are tearing apart the foundational architecture of the private markets.
Yeah, the Securities Act framework, it really is the absolute bedrock of the whole system.
Right, because I mean, imagine raising like $50 million for a company in a single afternoon, completely legally, without ever telling the public a single thing about it.
Sounds highly illegal, honestly.
Right. It sounds like some 1920s mob scheme, yeah. A smoky back room, briefcases of cash, zero transparency.
Yeah.
But, you know, that exact scenario happens literally every single day on Wall Street.
Yeah, all the time.
The private markets actually eclipse the public markets through sheer dollar volume. They operate in this fascinating high-stakes shadow world. But to understand it, you have to start with the statute that birthed it all, the Securities Act of 1933.
Exactly. If you want to understand anything else in this space, anything at all, you have to start right there.
And I look at legal frameworks usually with the expectation that they're built like, you know, a modern skyscraper. Mm-hmm. Steel beams, perfectly measured glass, a logical grid. But the world of securities law, especially for private offerings, It is not a clean, modern skyscraper at all.
Oh, not even close.
It's like this massive, sprawling, ancient fortress that was just built over a swamp, and there are trapdoors everywhere.
That swamp, by the way, was the crash of 1929. The entire regulatory framework we're discussing today was a direct, very visceral reaction to a market where promoters were literally selling shares of nothing to widows and orphans.
Right, just pure scams.
Pure scams. Mm-hmm. So Congress didn't build a clean skyscraper because they were busy fighting a massive chaotic fire. And the resulting structure is just, well, it's the definition of a legal minefield. If you don't know where the original 1933 foundation ends and the modern additions begin, you're going to fall right through the floor.
Which is exactly why this deep dive is so critical for you if you're prepping for the Series 82. We are looking at the statutory skeleton today. Every other rule you're going to study down the line, Reg D, Reg A, all the dizzying complexities of accredited investor qualifications.
Yeah, those are all just exceptions.
Right. They're just exceptions built on top of this one fundamental framework.
And the exam writers know this. They absolutely know it. They don't just test if you can regurgitate a specific rule in a vacuum. They want to see if you know which rule applies to a highly specific, often totally overlapping scenario.
Right.
If you don't understand the base framework, like the default setting of the law, the exceptions won't make any logical sense to you. You have to know what the default prohibition is before you can understand how to legally bypass it.
Exactly. So to keep us from falling asleep in a pile of SEC statutes, we're going to learn this entire framework through what might honestly be the worst business venture of all time.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
Yeah, I want to introduce you, the listener, to our recurring cast of characters. We're going to ride with them through the entire life cycle of a deal today. So first, we have Sam, the sponsor.
Okay, Sam.
Sam is our issuer. He is trying to raise millions of dollars for his completely absurd startup idea. Let's say it's a proprietary blockchain network built exclusively for tracking the ancestry of alpacas.
Wow. A truly visionary deployment of capital right there. I'm sure the macroeconomic headwinds for alpaca genealogy are, you know, quite favorable right now.
Unprecedented demand. Groundbreaking stuff. So that's Sam. Next, we have Riley the rep. Riley is the placement agent.
It's a guy selling it.
Right. It's Riley's job to somehow take this alpaca blockchain deal, package it, and sell it to someone with actual capital. And finally, we have Ingrid the investor.
Oh,
exactly. Ingrid is the person with the money. She is the target. And you need to keep this in mind. Every single rule, every statute, every court precedent we talk about today is designed to do one of two things. It either provides a legal mechanism for Sam and Riley to extract Ingrid's money, or, much more likely, it's designed to protect Ingrid from getting completely fleeced by Sam and Riley.
Right. But before Sam, the sponsor, can sell a single piece of paper to Ingrid, we have to establish threshold jurisdiction. Like, we have to figure out if the SEC even cares about what he's doing at all.
Because if it's not a security, none of this matters.
Exactly. If the instrument Sam is selling doesn't trigger the definition of a security under the Securities Act, then none of these rules apply. He can just sell alpaca tokens out of the trunk of his car without a care in the world.
Which brings us to the gateway. Mm-hmm. Section 1, the definitions. Let's start with the most basic one, and yet somehow the one that has spawned decades of litigation. What exactly is a security?
So the definition of a security is deliberately overwhelmingly broad. The drafters of the 1933 Act cast a massive net here because they knew human ingenuity, especially when fueled by greed, will always invent new ways to separate people from their money.
Right.
It's not just stocks and bonds. It includes notes, debentures, investment contracts, fractional undivided interest in oil and gas rights. I mean, it goes on and on.
Now, obviously, anyone taking the Series 82 already knows what a stock or a bond is. We don't need to retread basic finance here.
Hmm.
But that catch-all term you just used, investment contract, that refers to the Howey test, right?
Precisely, yeah, from the famous Supreme Court case involving the Florida citrus groves. An investment contract is essentially any transaction where a person invests money in a common enterprise, and they are led to expect profits solely from the efforts of the promoter or a third party.
Okay, so if Sam prints out some digital alpaca coin tokens,
right,
or a certificate saying Ingrid gets a 20% cut of the blockchain validation revenue, the SEC is going to look at that and say, yep, that's an investment contract.
Yeah.
That is a security.
Without a doubt. The government doesn't want people finding clever ways to rename their financial instruments just to dodge regulation. But let me give you, the listener, a highly strategic piece of advice for the Series 82 exam right now.
Ooh, yes. Hit us with the exam strategy.
For your purposes on this specific test, always assume that the instrument being discussed in the question is a security.
Wait, really? Always?
Always. The question will almost never be, is this a security? The exam assumes the jurisdiction already exists. The real question is going to be, assuming it is a security, what specific regulatory burdens now apply to it?
Okay, that makes sense. So assuming it is a security, let's look at the players. We know Sam the sponsor is the issuer. The statute defines an issuer simply as every person who issues or proposes to issue any security. That's clean. Very simple.
So straightforward.
But then we have the underwriter. The sources define an underwriter as any person who has purchased from an issuer with a view to the distribution of any security or participates in a direct or indirect participation in any such undertaking. That sounds incredibly broad, but there is a massive carve-out here for broker-dealers, isn't there?
There is, and it's a critical distinction regarding liability and regulatory burden. The definition of a statutory underwriter specifically excludes a person whose interest is limited to a commission from an underwriter or dealer, assuming it's not in excess of the usual and customary distributor's or seller's commission.
Let me make sure I'm translating this out of legalese correctly.
Yeah.
Why does the SEC care so much about separating the underwriter from the standard salesperson?
Because it separates the risk takers, right? The gatekeepers from the mere agents. An underwriter is fundamentally taking on a massive role in the offering. Like, in a firm commitment, they are literally buying the securities outright to distribute them. Even in a best effort scenario, they're the primary engine of the distribution. A broker who is just taking a standard commission to sell a few shares to a retail client, they are not an underwriter.
Got it.
The regulatory burden, the due diligence requirements, and the strict liability placed on a statutory underwriter are just immense. So defining who exactly falls into that bucket is crucial. The SEC wants to know who's neck to ring if the deal turns out to be a fraud.
So Riley the rep, our placement agent, assuming he is just getting his standard, let's say, 5% placement fee and isn't buying the alpaca tokens himself to resell them, he stays completely out of that statutory underwriter definition.
Generally, yes, he acts as an agent, though, as we'll see a bit later, that definitely doesn't mean he escapes liability entirely. Far from it.
Oh, I'm sure. Okay, let's unpack the communication side of things. Sam wants to get the word out. He wants to talk to Ingrid. The statute relies heavily on this concept of a prospectus. What exactly counts as a prospectus in the eyes of the SEC?
It's basically everything. Everything written or broadcast. The Securities Act defines a prospectus as any notice, circular, advertisement, letter, or communication written or by radio or television that offers any security for sale or confirms the sale of any security.
Wait, let me push back on that because that sounds completely unmanageable. If Sam, the sponsor, puts up a billboard on the highway that just says invest in alpaca blockchain, or if he just sends a tweet from his corporate account with a rocket ship emoji and a link to a term sheet, are you telling me that billboard and that tweet are legally prospectuses?
Yes. Yes, they are.
That's insane.
If it offers a security for sale and is in writing or broadcast, it functions as a prospectus under the statutory definition. And here's the kicker. If it is a prospectus, it has to comply with all the rules governing what a prospectus must contain, which is usually a massive list of audited financials and risk disclosures.
And obviously, a tweet cannot contain all of that.
Right. Which means the tweet is an illegal, non-compliant prospectus. You just violated the act.
Which leads us right into the biggest trapdoor of the entire foundation, the definition of an offer. I know the exam absolutely loves to trick people with this one.
It really does. You need to flag this in your mind right now. Listen carefully. Under the Securities Act, an offer or an offer to sell is not just a completed transaction. It's not just handing someone a contract. It is every attempt or offer to dispose of or solicitation of an offer to buy a security or interest in a security for value.
Okay, let's slow down and really look at that because it feels entirely counterintuitive to how normal business works. So I want you to picture this. Sam, the sponsor, just calls Ingrid on the phone, totally out of the blue, and says, "Hey, Ingrid, I've got a hot alpaca deal coming down the pipeline next month. You should get your checkbook ready."
Right.
But he hasn't actually sold her anything. She hasn't signed anything. No money has moved. No term sheet even exists yet. Is that phone call an offer?
Yes. 100% yes. That solicitation, that verbal attempt to gauge your interest and get her ready to buy, that is an offer to sell under Section 2A3 of the Act.
But why? I mean, if I'm Sam, I'm screaming at my lawyer right now. Why does the SEC care if two consenting adults with high net worth are just talking on the phone about a potential future deal?
Well, because the entire philosophical goal of the Securities Act is to ensure that investors have all the material, audited facts before they are psychologically pressured or, you know, excited into making an investment decision. If you let issuers hype up a deal, solicit interest, and condition the market before any disclosures are filed or available, you defeat the entire purpose of the law. You're letting them prime the pump with promises of riches so that by the time the actual boring, risky financial disclosures arrive, the investor is already emotionally committed to buying. The SEC calls this gun jumping.
Gun jumping. Okay, so if Sam calls Ingrid and makes that hype pitch, before he has filed anything with the SEC, he has already violated the registration requirement, even if no security ever changes hands and Ingrid just hangs up on him.
Exactly. The violation occurs the moment the solicitation happens. You don't need a completed sale. You don't even need a willing buyer to have a violation. The act of offering illegally is a crime in itself.
That is wild. And that brings us to the actual mechanical timeline, because you just mentioned before he has filed anything, we need to look at the three phases of the registration timeline. This is how a non-exempt deal actually moves forward through time, and it governs exactly what Sam can and cannot say.
Right. So the registration requirement, Section 5 of the Securities Act, it isn't just one blanket rule. It's really a mechanical timeline consisting of three separate phases, and the prohibitions shift depending on exactly what phase you are in.
Let's take it phase by phase. Phase 1, pre-filing. This is the period before Sam has filed any registration statement with the SEC. He's just sitting in his office with Riley, dreaming up the alpaca blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
What can they legally do to market this?
Nothing. Zero.
Nothing at all.
They are under a strict absolute gag order. Under Section 5C, no offers are permitted and no sales are permitted.
So any forward-looking statements, any market conditioning, any tweets, any phone calls to Ingrid, all of that could blow up the entire offering before it even starts.
Correct. If they try to hype the market during the pre-filing period, the SEC can impose a cooling off period.
Yeah.
And that essentially freezes the deal and costs the issuer millions in lost momentum and legal fees.
Yikes. Okay, let's move to phase 2. Filed, but not effective. So Sam has finally submitted his massive stack of paperwork, his S-1 registration statement, to the SEC. He is officially filed. But the SEC hasn't declared it effective yet. They're still reviewing the disclosures, checking his math, arguing over his risk factors. What can Sam do now?
Now, the rules loosen slightly. Offers are permitted. He can talk about it. He can send Ingrid a preliminary prospectus, which is often called a red herring because of the red ink on the cover, stating the information is not yet complete.
Okay, so he can talk.
He can talk. But crucially, no sales are permitted. Absolutely no money can change hands. No shares can be transferred. No contracts of sale can be signed.
He can market the deal, but he can't close the deal.
Exactly. He is gathering indications of interest. That's all he can do.
And then we hit phase 3, effective. The SEC finishes their review, they're satisfied with the disclosures, and they give the green light. The registration is declared effective.
Right. And now both offers and sales are permitted. The deal can actually close, but there is a catch. Any sale and any delivery of the security has to be accompanied or preceded by a final, fully compliant statutory prospectus.
Okay, I want to throw a direct scenario at you, the listener. Pause what you're doing and really think about this. Frame the timeline in your head. Put yourself in this exact situation on the exam. Sam, the sponsor, has finally filed his massive registration statement with the SEC on a Tuesday morning. It is stamped as received.
Tuesday. Got it.
He calls Ingrid that afternoon and sends her the preliminary prospectus. On Wednesday, Ingrid reads it. She's completely hyped about the Alpaca blockchain, and she calls Sam. She says, Sam, this is genius. Take my money right now. I want to lock in my allocation. Here is a wire transfer for $2 million.
Yeah.
Can Sam process that sale and accept the wire on Wednesday?
I'll give you a beat to think about it. Which phase are we in on Wednesday?
Just one day later.
The answer is absolutely not.
Because on Wednesday, the registration is only filed. It is not effective.
Exactly. Filing unlocks talking. Effectiveness unlocks closing.
Filing is talking. Effectiveness is closing. That is the mantra. Say it out loud if you have to. Filing is talking. Effectiveness is closing.
If you mix up the privileges of the filed phase with the privileges of the effective phase, the exam will punish you relentlessly. You have to keep that timeline rigidly structured in your head. Pre-filing, total silence. Filed, you can talk, you can gather interest, but you cannot touch the money. Effective. You can finally close the deal and cash the checks.
Now, if I am Sam the sponsor, I'm looking at this timeline and I am sweating. The public registration timeline is an absolute nightmare. It takes months, sometimes over a year. It requires audited financials. It requires exposing all of my proprietary alpaca tracking secrets to my competitors via the EDGR database. It costs millions in legal and accounting fees.
The public markets are a luxury, and they are priced accordingly.
Right. Sam looks at this and he says, I want out. I don't want to do a registered public offering. I just want to take Ingrid's money quietly and build my company. How do I bypass this entire Section 5 process?
And that leads us to the heart of the Series 82, the exemptions.
We are entering the realm of the hall pass. Exempt securities versus exempt transactions. Sam wants out of the registration timeline. He needs an exemption. But the exam is absolutely obsessed with the granular details of how he gets exempt.
Because not all exemptions are created equal. They solve Sam's immediate registration problem. They let him take the money without filing an S-1, but they do it in two fundamentally different ways. And those ways have massively different long-term consequences for Ingrid the investor.
Let's start with exempt securities. This falls under Section 3 of the Securities Act. The sources describe this as permanent immunity.
Yes. Section 3 specifies certain classes of securities that are entirely removed from the Section 5 registration requirement, regardless of how they are sold, who buys them, or how many times they change hands. The exemption is baked into the very DNA of the security itself. It stays exempt forever, through every subsequent resale until the end of time.
Give me the heavy hitters here. What kind of paper gets permanent immunity?
Government and municipal securities. Anything issued or guaranteed by the U.S. government, a state, or a local municipality. Bank securities. Insurance and endowment policies issued by regulated insurance companies. And one that the exam loves to test, short-term commercial paper.
Let's zero in on that last one.
Yeah.
Short-term commercial paper under Section 3A3. This feels like a classic exam trap. So if Sam, the sponsor, realizes he needs some quick cash and he issues a promissory note to Ingrid that matures in 6 months, is that automatically an exempt security just because it's short-term?
No. And that is exactly how the test writers will try to trip you up.
Okay, why not?
For short-term commercial paper to be an exempt security, it must satisfy two very strict conditions. First, it must have a maturity of 9 months or less at the time of issuance. That's 270 days.
Wait, why 9 months? That seems so incredibly arbitrary.
It dates back to the historical commercial cycles of the 1930s. 9 months was roughly the time it took to plant a crop, harvest it, and sell it, or for a factory to buy raw materials, manufacture goods, and sell the inventory. The exemption was designed for standard, rolling, operational business credit, not for long-term capital formation.
Oh, that's fascinating. Okay, so condition one, 9 months or less. What is condition two?
Condition two is the killer. The proceeds from the commercial paper must arise out of a current transaction or be used to fund current operations.
Okay, define current operations. If Sam issues 9-month paper to pay for his company's daily payroll or to pay his server hosting fees, is that exempt?
Yes. Payroll and utility bills are the definition of current operational transactions.
But what if Sam issues that exact same 9-month paper, but he uses the money to buy a massive piece of commercial real estate to build a new state-of-the-art alpaca farming facility that will take 3 years to construct?
Not exempt. Buying long-term fixed assets, building factories, purchasing real estate, those are capital expenditures. They are not current transactions. The short maturity alone is not enough. the SEC looks right through the maturity date to the actual purpose of the funding.
Wow.
Yeah, if you use short-term paper for long-term assets, you blow the Section 383 exemption, you are issuing an unregistered security, and you are in massive trouble.
So that is an exempt security. If it qualifies, it's safe forever. Now let's look at the other side of the coin. Section 4 of the Securities Act, exempt transactions. If exempt securities are permanent immunity, exempt transactions are the one-night pass.
Exactly. Rather than exempting the security itself based on what it is, Section 4 exempts how it is sold. The transaction itself is granted the hall pass. And the absolute most important example for your career in this exam is Section 4A2, transactions by an issuer not involving any public offering.
The private placement. This is the lifeblood of the Series 82. This is what Riley the Rep does every single day.
Right. When Sam sells his newly minted equity shares to a small, select group of wealthy, sophisticated investors like Ingrid behind closed doors, that specific transaction, that transfer from Sam to Ingrid, is exempt from registration under Section 4A2 and Regulation D.
But the security itself, the alpaca equity, is not inherently an exempt security.
No, it is just standard corporate equity. And this is the most critical conceptual distinction in this entire module. Let's build a metaphor to make the resale reality crystal clear, because I promise you, the exam will hammer you on this.
Think of it like this. An exempt security, like a U.S. Treasury bond, is like having a diplomatic passport. You can walk through customs forever in any country with zero hassle. You can hand that passport to your friend, and if it's an exempt security, they can walk through customs too. The passport itself grants immunity. An exempt transaction, on the other hand, is like having a VIP wristband to an exclusive nightclub for one night only.
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it. Let's trace what happens to Ingrid the investor in both scenarios. Scenario A, Ingrid buys a U.S. government bond. Because the bond is an exempt security, she can turn around and sell it to anyone tomorrow. Her neighbor, her mailman, anyone on the street. She doesn't have to worry about the Section 5 registration timeline at all.
Right. The bouncer at the club, the SEC, looks at the bond, sees the diplomatic passport, and waves her right through.
Now, scenario B, Ingrid buys into Sam's private placement under Regulation D. She uses her VIP wristband to get into the private deal. She writes the check. She buys the alpaca equity. The transaction between Sam and Ingrid was completely legal and exempt. But what happens when Ingrid wants to sell those exact same shares to her neighbor 6 months later?
The bouncer steps in.
Hard stop. She holds what is called a restricted security. The exemption, the VIP wristband, only covered Sam's initial sale to her. Her wristband expired the very moment she took possession of the shares. If she wants to resell them, she cannot rely on Sam's Section 482 exemption. She has to find her own exemption for her specific resale transaction like Rule 144, or she has to wait for Sam to file a registration statement.
The initial transaction was exempt. Her future resale is not.
The exam will test this concept in multiple disguises. They will describe a security that was originally sold in a private placement, and they will ask if the investor can freely resell it on the open market the following week. The answer is always no, unless a new exemption or a registration statement applies.
And this brings up a very specific exam trap flagged in our sources regarding the statutory origins of these rules. The exam tries to trick you by blending different safe harbors together. You absolutely cannot confuse Regulation D, which is the massive safe harbor for private placements, with Regulation A.
It is extremely tempting to look at all these exemptions, lump them together in your head as ways to avoid going public, and assume they all come from the exact same paragraph of the statute. They do not. The private placement exemption Regulation D is derived directly from Section 4A, the exemption for transactions not involving a public offering.
But Regulation A, where does that come from?
Regulation A traces back to a completely different part of the law, Section 3B. This is the SEC's specific statutory authority to create exemptions for small issues, subject to a strict dollar cap.
Okay, so if I'm studying for this, I'm thinking, who cares? Section 4, Section 3, it's just alphabet soup. Why does it matter where the rule came from?
It matters because the statutory basis dictates the resale consequences for the investor. Because Regulation A is rooted in Section 3B, treating it almost like an exempt security, for a limited time, securities sold under a Tier 2 Regulation A offering are generally unrestricted. They can be resold freely by non-affiliates immediately.
Wait, really? Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Contrast that with Regulation D. Because it relies on the Section 4A2 transactional exemption, securities sold under Reg D are restricted. If you treat them as having the same statutory origin, you will misinterpret the liquidity of the asset, you'll give your client terrible advice, and you will fail the exam question.
So a Red D private placement spits out restricted securities. A Red JIH, a small issue offering, operates under a different statutory umbrella and spits out freely tradable securities. You have to keep those buckets rigidly separate in your mind.
Never answer a question as though Reg D and Reg JIH share identical resale mechanics. It's a fatal error.
Let's move to Section 3, the building blocks. We are looking at the classes of securities. So Sam has his private placement exemption dialed in. He's got Riley the rep actively pitching the deal. Ingrid is interested. She's got her checkbook out. But what exactly is Sam printing out and putting in Ingrid's hands in exchange for her capital?
A private offering usually involves 5 potential classes of securities. These are the fundamental building blocks you will see in almost every private placement memorandum, or PPM. Now, the exam expects you to know the basics of what a stock and a bond are, but more importantly, it expects you to be able to identify what legal rights an investor actually holds based on the description of their position in the capital stack.
Let's hit the core 4 first, but let's talk about them through the lens of a private offering. First up, equity.
Equity represents a residual ownership interest in the issuer. The classic examples are common stock or preferred stock. If Ingrid buys equity, she owns a piece of the Alpaca blockchain company. But in a private deal, she's almost never buying common stock like you would on the NYSE. She is buying preferred stock.
Right, because if she is putting up millions of dollars in a highly illiquid, risky private deal, she wants protections. She wants liquidation preferences. She wants to know that if Sam's company goes bankrupt, she gets her money back before Sam gets a dime.
Exactly. Her equity sits higher in the capital stack than the founder's equity.
Okay, second class. Debt.
Debt represents a creditor claim against the issuer. This is a note, a bond, or a debenture. It carries a stated repayment obligation, an interest rate, and a maturity date.
So in this case, Ingrid isn't buying a piece of the upside of the company. She is lending money to Sam. Sam legally owes Ingrid money. But again, in private markets, this isn't just a simple IOU.
No, private debt is heavily negotiated. Ingrid will demand restrictive covenants. She will legally prohibit Sam from taking on additional debt or paying himself a massive salary until her loan is paid off. Distinguishing between the ownership upside of equity and the legally enforceable creditor claim of debt is the absolute first step in analyzing any scenario.
Third class, a convertible security.
A convertible security bridges the gap. It is typically a debt instrument or preferred stock that the holder has the contractual right to exchange for the issuer's common equity under stated terms, usually based on a conversion ratio.
So Ingrid starts out as a secured creditor. She holds the bond, she gets her interest payments, she has her downside protection. But if the Alpaca blockchain goes viral and the valuation skyrockets, she can trade that bond in, give up her creditor status, and become an equity owner to capture the massive upside.
It's the ultimate having your cake and eating it too security, which is why convertible arbitrage is such a massive strategy in private markets.
And fourth, a warrant.
A warrant is a derivative. It is a right to purchase the issuer's equity at a set price, the strike price within a set time period. Warrants are almost never sold on their own in a primary private offering. They are attached as a sweetener to a debt or preferred equity offering to entice the investor to close the deal.
Okay, here is where we need a direct side-by-side comparison, because convertible securities and warrants sound extremely similar to a casual observer. In both cases, Ingrid holds a piece of paper that gives her the right to acquire equity in the future. How do we tell them apart mechanically?
Let's break down the physical mechanics of the transaction, because this is exactly the nuance the exam will test you on.
Let's pause again. Direct question to you, the listener. Visualize the transaction. If Ingrid decides to use her convertible bond to get her common stock, does she get to keep the bond? What if she uses a warrant to get her common stock? Does she keep the original instrument then? Take a second.
Think about the mechanics of the trade. With a convertible security, the key operative word is exchanged. She surrenders the original instrument. She physically hands the bond back to Sam, and Sam hands her the common equity in return. The debt is extinguished. Sam no longer owes her interest.
She trades the paper for new paper.
Exactly. But with a warrant, the key operative word is exercised. She keeps the original instrument. Let's say she bought a bond that had a warrant attached to it. She keeps the bond, it remains active, it continues to pay her interest. But to get the equity, she has to pay cash out of pocket to the company at the set strike price. The warrant is a right to buy, not a right to trade.
Convertibles trade paper. Warrants take cash. If you see an exam scenario where the investor has to write a fresh check to the company to get the shares, you are looking at the exercise of a warrant. If they just hand in their old certificate and get a new one without spending a dime of new money, you are looking at the conversion of a convertible security.
Spot on. That is the mechanical differentiator that defines the class.
Now, pattern interrupt, stop everything. I have a crazy idea. What if Sam, the sponsor, wants to get creative with his offering? What if he takes a share of preferred stock and he physically staples a warrant to it and he tells Riley to sell them to Ingrid as one single combined package? Is this a brand new secret sixth class of security?
No. What you just described is the fifth element on our list.
A unit.
A unit. Just a unit.
Yes. A unit is simply a single security formed by bundling two or more of the other foundational classes together and sold as one combined instrument. The most common example in private placements is exactly what you described. One share of preferred equity plus one half of a warrant. So if it's just two existing things stapled together, why does it have its own distinct name?
Because initially, for a specified period of time, it trades and transfers as a single instrument. But this is the exam trap flag you need to watch out for. A unit is not its own unique class of ownership or debt. It has no independent legal characteristics. It is merely a packaging strategy. And critically, after a stated date in the offering documents, those components can typically be unstapled. They separate. And from that day forward, the stock and the warrant trade completely independently.
So Ingrid buys a unit. For the first 6 months, she has to hold the stock and the warrant together. If she manages to find a buyer for a restricted security, she has to sell them together. But on separation day, she can unstaple them. She can keep the stock for the dividends, and she can sell the warrant to a speculator.
Exactly. Don't let the exam trick you into thinking a unit represents some unique hybrid claim on the company's assets in bankruptcy. It's just a bundle of the core four classes.
All right, let's fast forward in our story. We are moving to section four, the game players, types of offerings and PIPEs. Let's pretend Sam's Alpaca blockchain somehow succeeded against all odds. It was a massive global hit.
Miracles do happen in the capital markets.
Sam grew the company. He hired thousands of employees. He did a massive IPO. And now his company is a fully reporting public company under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. They trade on the NASDAQ. They file 10Ks. They file 10Qs. They have earnings calls. But disaster strikes. A rival blockchain for llamas launches.
Oh, no, not the llama.
It is faster. It is cheaper. Sam is suddenly bleeding cash. He needs $50 million to pivot the company, and he needs it in 30 days. Doing a traditional registered secondary public offering will take months of SEC review. He can't wait. So he decides to do a new private placement, even though his company is already publicly traded.
Enter the PIPE.
Before we dissect PIPEs, let's lock down two fundamental definitions that get tossed around a lot. First, a primary offering.
A primary offering is simply a sale of newly issued securities, where the proceeds go directly into the treasury of the issuer. Sam is printing brand new shares, expanding the float, selling them, and the money goes into the company's bank account to fund operations. This stands in stark contrast to a secondary offering.
In a secondary offering, an existing shareholder, maybe Sam himself cashing out, or an early venture capital fund, sells their existing shares to the public. The total number of shares doesn't change, and the issuer, the company itself, receives absolutely nothing.
Correct. Knowing who gets the money is how you classify the offering.
Now, what is a private placement?
A private placement, as we discussed, is a primary offering that is exempt from Section 5 Securities Act registration, usually relying on Section 4A2 or Regulation D. It's capital formation conducted in the shadows away from the public eye.
Which brings us to the acronym of the hour, a PIPE. Private investment in public equity.
A PITE is simply a private placement made by an issuer that is already a reporting public company under the Exchange Act.
So, Sam is doing a private placement. He goes back to Ingrid the investor, who has since leveled up and is now managing a massive hedge fund. He says, Ingrid, I need cash now. The Llama blockchain is killing me. I will sell you a massive block of newly issued common stock behind closed doors without registering this specific transaction.
And because Sam is desperate for cash, and because he is bypassing the liquidity of the public market to get this deal done quickly, these PIPE shares are almost always sold to institutional investors like Ingrid at a significant discount to the current public market price of the stock.
Okay, here's where I'm going to push back, because if I'm looking at that from the outside, it seems like a massive glaring loophole in market structure. Sam's company is a public reporting company. Anyone in the world can go onto the SEC's EDGR website, read their 10K, and see all their audited financials. The public is fully informed. So if Ingrid buys these PIPE shares at a 20% discount, those shares are public, right? Can she just turn around the next morning, call her prime broker, dump those shares on the open market, and pocket a massive risk-free arbitrage profit?
And no, absolutely not. And that is the single biggest trap of this entire section.
But the company is public.
The company's reporting status is public, but the transaction between Sam and Ingrid was an exempt private placement. Remember our VIP wristband metaphor. The exemption only covered Sam's initial sale to Ingrid. The fact that the issuer is a public company does not magically transform the privately placed shares into unrestricted, freely tradable shares. Ingrid holds restricted securities.
So she is trapped. She bought discounted shares, but she is locked in a cage. She cannot sell them on the open exchange to realize that profit.
She cannot sell them immediately. The public reporting status of the company satisfies the disclosure requirement for the initial private buyers. Ingrid doesn't need Sam to write a 300-page private placement memorandum because she can just read his public 10K. But that 10K reporting does not auto-register her specific newly minted shares for public resale.
How did she get out of the cage?
As a contractual condition of the PIPE deal, Sam must commit to filing a resale registration statement, usually a Form S-3 with the SEC, shortly after the closing of the private deal. He essentially promises to register her specific shares for public resale. Once the SEC declares that specific resale registration statement effective, then and only then does Ingrid's restriction lift. Then she can sell her shares into the public market.
Wow. Okay, so if the exam asks you, an institutional investor buys equity shares in a PIPE offering from a fully reporting public company, are the shares immediately freely tradable? The answer is no. They are restricted securities.
You have to separate the issuer's reporting status from the investor's resale rights. Being a reporting company does not register anyone's specific shares. It just means the company files quarterly reports. The shares themselves need their own distinct regulatory path to liquidity.
Let's rewind the clock a bit. We've talked a lot about Sam and Ingrid, but we need to talk about the guy making the introductions. Section 5, the middleman, broker-dealer registration. Let's go back to when Sam first started, when he was still a scrappy private startup, and he hired Riley the rep to find investors.
Riley is our placement agent. He is the bridge between the capital seeker and the capital provider.
Right. And Riley is out there knocking on doors, making phone calls, soliciting high net worth individuals, trying to get people to buy Sam's alpaca tokens. What does the SEC have to say about Riley's role?
The rule is laid out in Section 15A of the Exchange Act, and it is brutally clear. A person or firm who solicits or affects sales of an issuer's securities in a private offering is acting as a broker. And it is unlawful to use the mails or any means of interstate commerce to affect these transactions unless that broker is officially registered with the SEC as a broker-dealer.
Wait a minute. Let me make sure I'm hearing you correctly. Even though Sam's transaction is exempt from registration, we established it's a Regulation D private placement, Riley, the rep, still has to be fully registered with the SEC as a broker-dealer to sell it.
Yes. This is a massive point of confusion for market participants. A private placement is exempt as a transaction under Section 4A2. It is not an exempt security. The duty to register as a broker-dealer reaches anyone acting as a placement agent or receiving transaction-based compensation for selling a non-exempt security, even if the transaction itself is perfectly exempt from registration.
This is the finder's debate that plagues the industry. People think if they just make an introduction and take a 5% cut, they don't need to be a broker-dealer.
And the SEC vehemently disagrees. If you are soliciting, negotiating, and taking a success fee based on the closing of a securities transaction, you are a broker. You must register.
But this is where the exam trap is flagged in our sources. The sources are very specific about what this specific registration rule actually covers. It's about registration, not conduct.
Exactly. Section 15A polices who may lawfully solicit or affect a private placement sale in the first place. It answers the binary threshold question of whether Riley is allowed to be in the game at all. It says absolutely nothing about what Riley must actually do once he is engaged in the business.
It's exactly like getting your driver's license.
Expand on that.
The DMV giving you a driver's license. That is your SEC broker-dealer registration. It just says you have passed the baseline test, you are in the system, and you are legally allowed to sit behind the wheel and turn the key. It gives you permission to operate on the road. But merely having a license in your wallet is entirely different from the traffic laws telling you not to run a red light or not to speed in a school zone or to use your turn signal. Those are conduct standards.
That is a phenomenal analogy. The SEC broker-dealer registration requirement is the license to drive. The rules regarding due diligence, suitability, anti-fraud, fair dealing, Those are the traffic laws, which are largely enforced by FENNR, the self-regulatory organization.
And the exam will try to trick you by mixing these up in a scenario.
Constantly. They will give you a long and detailed scenario where a placement agent fails to perform proper due diligence on a shady issuer, and they will ask you which rule the agent violated. If you select failure to register as a broker-dealer, you will get it wrong. The agent in the scenario might be perfectly registered. They just drove through a red light by failing their due diligence duty. Conversely, if an unregistered finder perfectly pitches a deal with 100% accurate information and exhaustive due diligence, they haven't violated a conduct standard regarding disclosure, but they have committed a massive violation of the registration requirement because they didn't have a license to drive in the first place.
You must isolate the registration question from the conduct question. When you are reading a question, always ask yourself, is this scenario testing who is legally allowed to sell, or is it testing how they behaved while they were selling?
Precisely. Keep the license separate from the traffic laws.
Which brings us perfectly to the climax of our story and the most terrifying part of the Securities Act. Section 6. The consequences. Civil liability. Okay, the deal is done. Riley solicited it. Ingrid bought it. Sam took the millions and built his alpaca tracking system. But wait, something went horribly wrong. The alpacas escaped. The blockchain crashed. The money is gone. The SEC knocks on the door, or Ingrid hires a ruthless securities litigator and files a massive lawsuit. What is the liability?
When a security sale goes bad, there are two separate liability standards under the Securities Act that can apply. They are found in Section 12. And the exam heavily rewards the candidate who knows exactly which standard governs the specific fact pattern you are looking at.
Let's do a side-by-side comparison of the two liabilities. Liability 1, registration violation. This is Section 12A1. What is the rule here?
The rule under Section 12A1 is that anyone who offers or sells a security in violation of the Section 5 registration requirement, meaning it was an unregistered offering that ultimately failed to qualify for a valid exemption, is liable to the purchaser.
Okay, so let's apply this. Sam and Riley thought they had a valid Regulation D private placement, but they screwed up the paperwork. Maybe they accidentally solicited an unaccredited investor, or they engaged in general solicitation by tweeting about the deal too early. The SEC comes in, investigates, and says, nope, you blew the Reg D safe harbor. Your exemption is invalid. They have committed a registration violation.
Yes, they have sold an unregistered and non-exempt security.
What is the remedy for Ingrid? What does she get?
The remedy is called rescission. It means legally rewinding the clock as if the transaction never happened. Ingrid gets her consideration paid back, her full principal plus statutory interest, minus any income she received from the security while she held it, like a dividend.
Let's put some math to this to make it real. Let's say Ingrid invested $1 million. While she held it, she received a $50,000 dividend. Then the alpaca company implodes, the stock crashes, and she sells her shares to a distressed debt buyer for $200,000. What are her damages?
Let's calculate the rescission damages. You take her initial $1 million. You add statutory interest. Let's say that's $50,000 for the time period. So we are at $1,050,000. You subtract the $50,000 dividend income she received, back to $1 million. Then you subtract the $200,000 she recovered when she sold the residual shares. Sam and Riley are on the hook to write her a check for $800,000.
She gets made whole, period.
Period.
Now, what is the defense? If Riley goes into federal court, looks at the judge and says, Your Honor, I tried really hard. I hired expensive securities lawyers. We honestly thought we had a valid exemption. It was a clerical mistake. We didn't intend to violate the law. Does that defense work?
And no. And this is the terrifying part. There is no affirmative defense against rescission liability for a Section 12A1 registration violation. It is strict liability. If you sold an unregistered non-exempt security, you lose. End of story. It doesn't matter how careful you were, how much you paid your lawyers, or how good your intentions were.
Strict liability. No defense. If the exemption fails, you write the check. Now let's look at liability 2. Material misstatement or omission. This is Section 12A2. What is the rule here?
This liability triggers when anyone offers or sells a security by means of a prospectus or an oral communication that contains an untrue statement of a material fact or omits a material fact necessary to make the statements in light of the circumstances under which they were made, not misleading.
So this isn't about paperwork or exemptions. This is about lying or hiding the ugly truth.
Yes. And critically, this liability reaches a security whether or not it is exempt from registration. An exempt Regulation D private placement is squarely inside this liability zone. You cannot use an exemption as a shield to lie to investors.
So even if Sam has a perfect bulletproof Reg D exemption, If Riley lies to Ingrid about how much revenue the alpacas are generating, they're liable under Section 12A2.
Yes.
What is the remedy?
The remedy is the exact same math we just did. Rescission or rescissory damages. Ingrid gets her money back.
But what is the defense? Does Riley have a defense this time, or is it strict liability again?
Yes. Here, the seller has an affirmative defense. Riley can avoid liability if he can sustain the burden of proof that he did not know, and in the exercise of reasonable care, could not have known of the untruth or omission. This is the reasonable care defense.
Okay, let's explore that, because reasonable care sounds incredibly subjective. If I'm Riley's lawyer, I'm going to argue he did everything he could. How does a court actually define reasonable? If Sam forged the revenue documents and Riley did a background check but didn't hire a forensic accountant to audit Sam's hard drive, does Riley win that defense?
It depends heavily on Riley's role and the red flags available. The court looks at the standard of due diligence expected in the industry. If the forgery was highly sophisticated and Sam provided fake bank statements that matched the fake revenue, and Riley conducted standard background checks, interviewed management, and reviewed the documents without finding inconsistencies, Riley can likely raise the reasonable care defense and avoid liability. He acts as an agent, not the primary fraudster.
Because this liability turns on the truth of what was said, the law allows a defense based on how carefully the seller tried to verify that truth.
Exactly. The law punishes negligence and fraud, but it doesn't demand omniscience.
Okay, scenario time. Direct question to the listener. Put your exam hat on. This is where the concepts collide. Here's the scenario. Riley, the rep, sells Ingrid an offering. It turns out there was a massive legal error by the law firm, and there was no valid exemption. They accidentally engaged in general solicitation. The offering was an illegal, unregistered public offering. But Riley's disclosures to Ingrid were 100% truthful, perfectly accurate, and he exercised an insane amount of reasonable care in verifying every single fact. The business was exactly as described. The alpacas were real. But the stock price drops due to macroeconomic factors. Ingrid sues to get her money back, citing the registration failure. Does Riley have a defense?
Think about which statutory standard applies to a registration failure. The answer is no. Riley has absolutely no defense.
Why? He told the complete truth. He did perfect due diligence.
Because rescission liability for a registration violation under Section 12A1 does not care about disclosure quality. It does not care about the truth. The fact that Riley told the truth is entirely irrelevant if the security was unregistered and non-exempt. If it wasn't registered and wasn't exempt, you face strict liability, you lose.
And let's flip it around. If the offering had a perfect bulletproof registration exemption, but Riley made a material misstatement about the alpaca revenue, he is liable under Section 12A2, unless he can prove reasonable care. The exam will give you complex fact patterns that blend these two things together. A scenario where the registration is flawed but the truth is told, or a scenario where the registration is perfect but a lie is told. You have to know which liability standard is triggered, because that determines whether a defense exists at all.
One turns purely on the mechanical registration status. The other turns purely on the qualitative truth of what was said. Do not mix them up.
Okay. We are coming to the end of our deep dive into the statutory skeleton. We have covered a massive amount of ground. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the most critical, highly testable takeaways. We volley these back and forth. You ready?
Let's do it.
The registration timeline. Filing is talking. Effectiveness is closing. You cannot accept a check during the cooling-off period.
Exemptions. An exempt security under Section 3 is permanent immunity. An exempt transaction under Section 4A2 is a one-time hall pass. And the investor's subsequent resale of that security remains restricted.
Classes of securities. Units are just bundles of other securities, not a new, unique class with independent rights. And when comparing derivatives, convertibles, trade paper, warrants take cash to exercise.
Pipe PEs. A pipe is a private placement executed by a public company. The Pipe PE shares are still heavily restricted upon issuance, even though the issuer is a public reporting company, until a resale registration statement goes effective.
Liability. Rescission liability for a registration violation is strict liability. There is absolutely no reasonable care defense. If you miss the exemption, you owe the money back.
Excellent recap. Those are the pillars of the Series 82 framework.
As we wrap up, I want to leave the listener with something to chew on, something that bridges these seemingly disparate concepts together into the real world.
Let's think about the intersection of Pipe PEs and liability. If a public company rushes a Pipe PE transaction to get cash fast, and they sell to institutional investors at a steep discount, those investors are locked up holding restricted securities. The company contractually promises to file a resale registration statement, the S3, shortly after closing, usually within 30 to 45 days. But what happens if the public markets violently crash while those PIPE investors are locked up waiting for the SEC to declare that resale registration effective?
They're trapped in the cage while the building burns down.
Exactly. If the stock price plummets below the heavily discounted price they paid, and they can't legally sell because they are restricted under Section 5, who bears that massive market risk? The investor does. It completely changes how you view the so-called discount that PIPEs are sold at. That 20% discount isn't just a fun bonus for being rich. It's a calculated risk premium for surviving the illiquidity of the lockup period while waiting for the registration to become effective. It is compensation for regulatory friction.
That is a brilliant way to look at it. You connect the timeline, the resale restrictions, and the brutal market reality all in one scenario. Remember, this whole framework isn't just a list of rules to memorize. It's the blueprint of the swamp. Once you see where the trap doors are, the rest of the Series 82 exam starts to look a lot less intimidating. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep grinding, keep studying, and we'll catch you next time.